This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
This week on Freakonomics Radio, we look back at our 2016 interview with U.S. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, now that he's one of the 20 Democrats running for president. Booker says he's an optimist, despite the obvious hardships many Americans experience.
My parents never hesitated to show me the wretchedness, the bigotry, the darkness of American life.
But he's a realist when it comes to what can and cannot be accomplished in politics.
We put a lot of great people in a broken system where there's a lot of things that I think work against us getting things done.
Also this week, a taste of Freakonomics Radio Live, including the relationship between politics and disgust.
The more easily disgusted people say they are, the more likely they are to be toward the right of the scale.
That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio right after this hour's news. Cory Booker, the junior United States senator from New Jersey, is 50 years old. He was a superstar athlete in high school, went to Stanford on a football scholarship, won a Rhodes Scholarship, and studied at Oxford, then got a law degree at Yale. With that pedigree, and with any number of options open to him, what did he do? He moved to Newark, one of the poorest big cities in the U.S. He served on the city council and then as mayor. By most accounts, he did a good job, uniting longtime rivals and lifting the city up. But as one journalist wrote, Booker's detractors saw him as, quote, an infuriating phony who cares more about national fame than problem solving.
Newark Mayor Cory Booker is prepared for a food stamp challenge. He plans to live for a week on the monetary equivalent of food stamps or less.
On the way to the shore, Senator Booker made a stop to help with some shoveling.
Where the mayor's digging his people out one constituent at a time.
He'd just gotten home when he saw the house next door on fire, a woman trapped inside.
He ran into a burning building to save a neighbor.
They got her out alive, and Mayor Booker was taken to the hospital for smoke inhalation.
They are calling the super mayor tonight.
Cory Booker, a Democrat, has been in the U.S. Senate since 2013, when longtime New Jersey Senator Frank Lautenberg died in office. Booker easily won a special election that year, and 1 year later, he won the regularly scheduled election. When we spoke back in 2016, he was in the throes of a tour for his new book, which was called United: Thoughts on Finding Common Ground and Advancing the Common Good. Let me ask you this, Senator Booker. Most politicians' books are pegged to running for office, most. So why, look, you have a great story to tell, and you have a lot of things to talk about that you do well in this book. But I am curious about the timing. Why now?
Well, I'm really finished with a stage of my life. Being a mayor is different than any other political job in America. I still remember my first time coming to the Senate as a mayor. Dianne Feinstein, a senator from California, runs over to me. I don't know her. And she looks at me and says, "You have the hardest job in American politics." Well, a big city mayor, especially the mayor of a city with a lot of challenges, high poverty, crime, it's a 24/7 nonstop job. I finished that, and then I had to do two successive races for the United States Senate, which was very intense in and of itself. And after going through a long period of intense living, I had a chance to take a deep breath. And then I realized, hey, everywhere I went around the state, people on the left side of the aisle, right side of the aisle, suburban, urban, were all saying to me how much they bemoaned how divided our country was, how divided our politics were.
In Booker's view, this division is the biggest problem in modern politics, and he got to see a lot of it as an active campaigner for Hillary Clinton's presidential run in 2016. I do wonder how much more difficult is the notion of finding common ground during a presidential campaign.
It is incredibly difficult, period, and more difficult in silly season, as many call it, during a presidential election. But, you know, as Kennedy said, we do things because it's hard, not because it's easy. The most worthwhile things in life are difficult. And you say common ground. I use very purposefully the word love. I reject words like tolerance, where we say we're a nation of tolerance. That's kind of a cynical or lazy state of being that I'm just going to stomach your right to be different. If you disappear off the face of the earth, I'm no better or worse off. That love, where we say patriotism, love of country, which therefore demands a love of Americans, is a much harder way to go. You become much more vulnerable. You're much more prone to be broken and to fail. But the rewards of love, that difficult, challenging road, will always be greater than a cynical way that is short-term gain or short-term political points.
Maybe it's because he's still relatively new in the Senate, but Booker seems to believe that partisanship is not insurmountable.
I'm so proud that I've got bills and amendments passed with everybody from Ted Cruz to Chairman Inhofe, the Republican chairman of the EPW committee, who famously brought a snowball to the Senate floor. I found friendships in unexpected places, a genuine goodness in folks that I would not have discovered if I labeled them as Tea Party or Republican. But I found that common ground, and it's resulted in some good things.
Booker's biggest legislative priority is criminal justice reform. In 2015, he and nine other senators introduced the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. The Senate Judiciary Committee passed the bill, but it never received a vote on the full Senate floor, even after the bill was reintroduced in 2017.
Our federal prison population has exploded since 1980. Our state prison population is about 500% overall since 1980. And it is probably one of the worst self-inflicted wounds in tough economies where other countries are investing in public universities, the speed of their rail, the quality of their ports. America's percentage of investment in infrastructure, this percentage of GDP has been going down. And except for one area, we've had this massive expense that no other country's done to themselves. In this country, where we have just 5% of the population, but one out of every four of the imprisoned people on the planet Earth are here in America. And so this is something that hurts everybody in America, from the money we're spending, assault on liberty, to the destruction of many communities and the perpetuation of violence. Because when somebody gets out of prison for a nonviolent drug offense, they suddenly can't get, in many states, food stamps. They can't get housing, public housing. They can't get business licenses.
As I understand it, you were making good progress, but now things have slowed down. I'd love to hear you talk for just a couple minutes about what you're trying to accomplish.
So I go to the Senate with a mission to undermine what I think is a cancer on the soul of our country, find incredible allies across the aisle, working closely with Koch Brothers team, with Newt Gingrich, even Grover Norquist.
Can you go back and say that again, just in case anybody missed who you were working together with as a Democratic senator from from New Jersey?
You know, I just got a sweetest note from the wife of the Koch Brothers general counsel. Mark Holden and his wife have become legitimate friends. I love and respect them. Grover Norquist, who's castigated by many people on my side of the aisle, sat in my office when I first came to the Senate and talked passionately about this issue. Newt Gingrich is an activist in this issue and involved in it. You know, and on the Senate floor, people like Mike Lee, people like Rand Paul, people like Chuck Grassley has become a leader and a champion on this issue. And so I've introduced a lot of pieces of legislation. Some of them have gotten bicameral and bipartisan support. But you're right. Right now, we've had this good legislation in the Senate, moved out of Judiciary Committee, hit the floor, and we're seeing some challenges to it. So there's ongoing negotiations right now to try to shore up our base on the Republican and Democrat sides in the Senate. So I've been feverishly working the phones to try to make sure that this legislation, which, by the way, it's compromised legislation, I don't think it's great. I think it's very good. And it, more importantly, it reverses the trend of this country to get us back on the track of moving towards common sense in our criminal justice system, as well as ideals towards redemption, where we are a nation that, if there's been great people from James Baldwin to Nelson Mandela who say, if you want to see the truth of a country, don't visit their halls of power. Go to their prisons and jails and see who they are incarcerating. We in America shamefully, overwhelmingly incarcerate the mentally ill, the drug addicted, the poor, and the brown people of our country. And we do not have a justice system, which we say over the Supreme Court, when I walk out of the Capitol, I see it's a equal justice under law. So I'm hoping that we're going to make some progress. I'm increasingly worried as we get closer and closer to the presidential election, but I'm going to be fighting with all my grit to get this over the finish line.
You write about the irony, what you call the irony, that Congress passed the so-called crime bill of 1995 after crime had begun to decline. And you cite research. This is on page 164 of your book. You cite research by the Pew Charitable Trust and the National Research Council that shows, I'll quote you to yourself, no correlation between our massive increases in sentencing and imprisonment and this decline, the crime decline. Now, I do know of research that we've written about, actually, in Freakonomics that argues the opposite, that imprisonment, as many reasons as there are to not like massive imprisonment, and I think that's easy to come up with a long list. And as much as we can agree that a lot of imprisonment is completely not appropriate to the crime, there is evidence that suggests that imprisonment does reduce crime overall. But when I went to look at the research that you're citing in the book, I found that there was no index in your book, but also no notes at all in the back, as there usually is with nonfiction books. There's no citation of sources or bibliography. So why is that? I realize that the book is a politician's story, but it's also read by some people like me as a book about nonfiction arguments, and I want that stuff. So I am curious why you, as the author, didn't include the cites so that, you know, a skeptic like me can be assured that you're telling the full truth.
Oh, well, that's, first of all, fair criticism. Because we made a conscious decision, number one, to back up everything we had. So if a reporter was to say, okay, you say X, where'd you get it from? So I can definitely get you the information if you want it. But we didn't put it in the back of the book. And that's a fair criticism.
Why? I am actually curious as an author, though, why do you not? Because, you know, it's not like you have to pay for the extra pages. A publisher will pick that tab.
No, well, for me, a lot of the things we cite, and we tested it, a simple Google search, a Pew studies of incarceration. We give enough hints there that if a dutiful person wanted to find it, it's easily found.
In other words, I'm an old-fashioned old guy who is paging through the paper version, and there aren't enough of me to count. Okay, I accept your answer.
And then, you know, look, we have now the majority of states, pretty much all of them, with a few exceptions, three state exceptions, who have lowered, and it's been more than half of American states have been making criminal justice reform, lowering their prison populations, and most of them have seen, overwhelming most of them have seen a drop in crime at the same time. Now, that's correlation, isn't causation, but the flames are often fanned with people who just think, oh, lock them all up. But you can look at other nations from similar nations like us, Canada, to ones like Russia, with much lower incarceration rates, much less expenditures of taxpayer dollars, that are not experiencing the levels of crime that we are. What is the most humane way and the most economically sound way, fiscally conservative way, to deal with the problem of crime? Is it to do things that disempower people, that make them more likely to commit crime? Because, by the way, when you take a nonviolent offender, lock them up, they often lose their job. And then you do things like the incredible use of solitary confinement in this country, which, again, put in solitary confinement, you'll find a lot of data on how that actually triggers mental health problems, worsens mental health problems. The way we conduct our criminal justice system belies common sense, fiscal sense, and moral sense.
As a former mayor of a city like Newark, Booker has seen more and thought more than most senators about the knock-on effects of high incarceration, especially for drug crimes.
And since we persecute the drug war in the poor neighborhoods, we persecute the drug war disproportionately against minorities, because there is no difference between blacks and whites at all in using drugs or even dealing drugs. But we know now from a lot of data that blacks are about 3.7 times more likely to be arrested for it. And when arrested for the same crime, blacks will on average get about a 20% longer sentence. What we're doing with particularly men in these communities for doing things that I witnessed in my affluent town I grew up in, especially on college campuses where dorms are not being raided, people coming home from a frat party are not being stopped and frisked, and if they were, there'd be a lot more arrests on college campuses. What we're doing in these particularly poor communities is driving the very things we're then condemning people. In fact, lots of data shows we'd have 20% less poverty in America if we had incarceration rates that were similar to our industrial peers.
Let me ask you about family for a moment. The share of kids in the U.S. living with a single parent has risen a lot over the recent decades, as I'm sure you know. It was 9% in 1960, 19% in 1980, roughly 34% today, one out of three kids in the U.S. living with a single parent. And research shows that a two-parent home is generally much more desirable. So I am curious, for all the reforms that the Democratic Party in particular talks about. It doesn't talk much about family reform. Maybe a less loaded way of putting that would be parental responsibility. But especially as the Democratic Party attracts many minority voters and a large share of the single parent families are minority families. Only 16% of white kids live in single mother families compared with 27% of Latino kids and 52% of African American kids. So I'm curious, as someone who happens to be a minority from a two-parent household whose father was from a single-parent household, with the rise in single parenthood over these years, what you think should be done, if anything? I know you're working from the government side of things, not from the family side of things, but where should the two meet?
Well, first of all, I love data, and this is one of the reasons why I think you have a great show, because when I was mayor, I said, in God we trust, but everybody else bring me data. And, you know, any American that doesn't understand the differences between single-parent households, it's dramatically different in terms of socioeconomic status, college attendance, a lot of very dramatic data on that that's worthy of digging into. And I was mayor of a city where about roughly 70% of my kids were born in poverty, and 70%, not saying there's any correlation here, but about 70% of my kids were born to single parents. But there is a nexus here between policy and what some would like to call family values, because the policy we have in this country works against the development of strong families and strong children, especially when you look at our competitors globally and what they're doing to support families and children and what we're not doing. And one of the great examples of this, we're the only country, industrialized country. In fact, the Congo and Afghanistan have paid family leave. But yet we put American parents every single day who are working full-time jobs, often double shifts, because the minimum wage has not kept up with inflation since 1960. It'd be about 30% higher if it just kept up with inflation. It'd be much higher than that if it kept up with productivity. That you have parents who have these tragic choices every day in America between being there for a sick child or missing a payday, missing a paycheck, which would plunge them into poverty, might even put them at risk of losing their car or losing their apartment. We are a country, compared to our peers, who are not investing in, again, something else that makes for strong families, strong children, which is universal pre-K. Our competitor nations are understood that there is a direct economic link between kids who are involved in preschool and kids that are not, in terms of their productivity in the long term. So there's all of these policies that other countries do to support families, to support children, that we, really the anomaly, the outlier, don't do. And then we turn around and point fingers at families for being bad parents.
You write very movingly in the book of your parents. You call them your constant mentors, my first and greatest teachers. You refer to your dad in particular as a superhero to me throughout my life. Your book is the memoir of someone raised in an extremely loving and extremely solid two-parent household with additional support from grandparents. How important would you say that has been to your success?
I mean, it is all that I am. And added to that was a community that I grew up in where I became an All-American high school football player because of men and women in a small town in northern New Jersey who worked full-time jobs and still came home and coached me. People on my block who were my parents, both working parents, couldn't necessarily let me come in. They'd have me over their homes and give me food as I did my homework. So I am, in many ways, what my father said, that result of a conspiracy of love. He would recount to me what black people and white people and Christians and Jews, all these folks that dislodged my family from poverty, not through some big piece of legislation, not through some big speech or campaign, but ordinary Americans committed to these ideals of our country who showed extraordinary love, kindness, and decency, that they may have been small acts, but in their aggregate, they amounted to a transformative change of a family that really shouldn't have broken out of poverty, but did, not just because of a hardworking dad, but because of this interdependency that was made manifest in spirit and in action. But you have to understand, my parents never hesitated to show me the wretchedness, the bigotry, the darkness of American life, and telling me the stories of the challenges still to go. And that's what I love, is I've never been one that wanted us to sanitize or whitewash our history or our present. That to be a hopeful American doesn't mean ignoring the challenges. And so you're right, I had this incredible foundation, but my parents pointed my moral compass directly at the unfinished business of this country and said, I can't pay back the blessings I inherited. As my father said, you now can't pay that back, but you've got to pay it forward.
Coming up after the break, I am pretty sure that Senator Booker calls me a coward.
I'm not going to project onto you cynicism, but I often say cynicism is a refuge for cowards.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by TransferWise, an online service that lets people send and receive money internationally. And their borderless account lets customers hold and convert multiple currencies at any time. More at TransferWise.com and the app. Freakonomics Radio is supported by Indeed. With Indeed, employers can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on a short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Cory Booker grew up in a middle-class black family in the mostly white town of Harrington Park, New Jersey. His parents were among the first black executives to work at IBM, his father in sales, his mother in marketing. Today, Booker is one of just three African-Americans in the U.S. Senate. In his book, United, he writes about race through his own experience. Chapter one, for instance, begins...
The chapter begins, I hate Henry Louis Gates because of some very humbling things he did to me.
It's a great chapter about your white ancestry, how Skip Gates led you on this DNA hunt. And it's fascinating. And you discover that you have nearly as much European DNA as African-American DNA. I think you're 47 to 45. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
But here's what I want to ask you. Is it not strange that race in the U.S. and elsewhere is still so extraordinarily, I guess, black or white rather than black and white? What I mean by this is, look, you have white ancestors, as do many African Americans. President Obama has a white mother, and yet he's rarely referred to as half white. He's viewed as black for the most part. I know it's been a long time since the old one drop of blood rule, but... it seems to be almost in a strong effect now, and I'm really curious about your views on this and the way we look at and talk about and agonize over race generally.
Well, sure. And for me, it's very, very straightforward. First of all, how nice would it be to say there's no black, there's no white, we're all just shades of the rainbow, all equal, and that sounds really nice. But we live in a society in which you experience institutions in this country very differently based upon your race. Fascinating studies out of places like Harvard, where just changing the picture on a resume changes the outcome of the job that the person will get. Fascinating studies about the criminal justice system or the things like the death penalty, where you're dramatically more likely to get the death penalty if you're a minority who's killed somebody that's white. To not talk about race in America with its profound consequential nature, to not confront these things and to say as a society, this is not a black or white issue. This is an American issue where we're all invested in this because of our values as a country, equality under the law, common destiny, to me is fallacy to say we're beyond race at this point in our country's history when we still should be talking about it. And so for me, I was taught to revere my parents. God bless them, because they were like, Cory, your liberty has come about through the struggles of blacks and whites, gay folk and straight folk. They really wanted to let me know the debt that I owed. When we moved into Harrington Park, we were denied. My parents were racially steered out of there. They got a white couple to pose as them.
You tell this great story about a sting that had to occur for your parents to buy the house that they were fully entitled to buy but were being kept from buying. Yeah.
Right. And involved in this elaborate sting operation were black people and white people. And so this is what my parents wanted me to celebrate in my life. The beauty, the magnanimity, the love of all races that enabled my family that moved to where we are. But it would be folly to the legacy of struggle of those blacks and white Americans to not continue to move until we can get to that point in our country where, and you love statistics, where the statistical outcomes are not so deeply affected by the color of someone's skin.
Can I just tell you for a minute why I personally hate politics, and maybe you tell me why I should hate it a little bit less? Would you be willing to defend your occupation? So And I'm sure I'm not speaking just for myself. I think I'm speaking for many, many, many people. So let's start with this. In economics and elsewhere, there's a principle that I'm guessing you've run across called the principal agent problem. And that means, you know, when there are a variety of people involved in what seems to be a team pursuit, a principal and an agent or a bunch of agents, we're all kind of rowing in the same direction. The fact is that often the principal and agent have misaligned incentives. And I think that's the way it feels for certainly me and a lot of people when you look at politics. It seems as though most people who get into politics, into electoral politics, really do have great priorities. They really want to represent their constituents and accomplish the most good they can. And yet, the way the system is set up, it seems as though many, if not most politicians, once they're in office, in the game, they start to respond to their private incentives rather than those public incentives. And I wonder if you could just talk about that struggle. Maybe you're so relatively new into national politics that you're still pure and still feel like you're representing constituencies and ideas as best as you can. But I'd be really curious to tell if you could tell people why politics is less rotten than we all think.
Well, I've had now two dramatically different experiences. I was an executive as a mayor, and then it was the big picture for me always. And I used to get frustrated with my legislature, who seemed to be concerned about short-term things or things that weren't to the bigger issues that we were dealing with. And I remember when I told a friend of mine, Mike Bloomberg, that I was going to be running for the Senate, and he, having been an executive too, gave me this gruff answer, almost like I disappointed a big brother, who, by the way, Mayor Bloomberg, for those interested in politics, gave me the best advice in politics I've ever gotten, which is, Corey, before you become a mayor, become a billionaire. And it's
not beholden to anybody forever then, right?
Exactly, exactly. But he just said to me something that I'll never forget. He said, Corey, legislators in Congress are concerned with these first three priorities before anything else. And he said very skeptically, re-election, re-election, re-election. And so we put a lot of great people in a broken system where there's a lot of things that I think work against us getting things done, from the campaign finance system that is profoundly broken and I think perverse, to just the way we draw our congressional lines. We draw our district lines bluer and bluer and redder, and we wonder then why the margins seem to control the center. So in the legislature, I see a lot of forces like that happening. And then the thing that, for me as a former executive, that sort of bothers me sometimes is that you get caught up in just this two-year cycle or the next crisis, as opposed to looking at this larger way. In fact, I often say that if we were running this country like America, Inc., we would be making much better decisions about what to do. Companies are often concerned with their physical plan, staying ahead of the competition, the quality of their employees. We've stopped investing in our physical plan, our infrastructure, the way we should. We've stopped concerned about staying ahead of the competition, research and development. We're going down on that percentage of our GDP. And then the quality of our employees, the training of the next generation of American workers, we're not doing the common sense things that our competitors are doing. But this is the final thing I'll say to you, who used a very strong word, which was hate. And I'm not going to project to you onto you cynicism, but I often say cynicism is a refuge for cowards, that it is a toxic spiritual state, that it so clouds our ability to see faint possibilities and hope amidst the glaring problems that we often wipe our hands of any engagement whatsoever. We allow our inability to do everything to undermine our determination to do something about the problem. One of the biggest challenges, I think, in our democracy is because of feelings like you have, more and more people get less involved, which then creates the very problems that we are worried about because it's lack of accountability. The Colosseum in Rome, the Latin says, who will watch the watchers? Latin or Greek, I'm not sure what the language is. Who will watch the watchers? And the best example I give this, and forgive me if this sounds a little partisan to you, but in 2008, when I went to vote, there was a line wrapped around my voting place like I'd never seen before. Barack Obama versus John McCain. And the turnout all across New Jersey was like set records. 1 year later is the gubernatorial race in New Jersey. John Corzine, incumbent governor, running against a guy you may never heard of, but his name is Chris Christie. And there was no line. I went in and voted easily. I hugged the poll worker that was there because she looked lonely. And then John Corzine lost. Chris Christie won. And if the turnout in urban spaces especially had been just maybe 75% of what it had been the year before, John Corzine would have won. Different priorities, and so Chris Christie gets in office and pulls us out of what's called regional greenhouse gas agreements, agreements to lower pollutants in the air. Remember, in cities like mine, asthma rates are incredibly high. He cuts funding to Planned Parenthood's. People are coming to me about Planned Parenthood doors closing. He lowers the earned income tax credit, which is a virtual tax increase on low-income workers. He cuts funding to cities. Every major city in New Jersey had to lay off cops or cut their police force. So people start coming to me complaining about all of this. And I say, what are you talking about? Why are we complaining or pointing the fingers at Chris Christie when it really wasn't about him? It was about our lack of action and engagement. And so when I encounter skepticism about politics, I just tell people, don't expect the politics of our country to change unless you do. Who are we in this day and age where we are, relative to the globe, enjoying such comforts and conveniences? Why would we give up right now or surrender to cynicism at a time that our politics and our nation demand more engagement, or else we will start to veer off course and become a country that's a shadow of our greatness of the past?
Senator, I accept your challenge to shed my cynicism, although I would argue it's more skepticism than cynicism, but I take your point entirely. But just to prove that I haven't divorced myself from thinking about improving the system, I do want to run one idea I've had by you, and I cannot, I've run this past a lot of politicians. I've never gotten much traction with it, but I think you might be the man. Let me say, it's impossible. It would never happen. But here's one proposal. How about we change the incentives in our legislative system? Let's think about U.S. Congress or the U.S. Senate. And rather than inviting people to run for office and then be dogged by the need to be reelected and raise more money and then engage in short-termism legislatively because of the need for reelection and so on, what if legislators were remunerated differently? What if they were essentially awarded the equivalent of stock options when their work pays off? So if you're working on a transportation project, education, whatever, and it might not be for 10 or 20 years, you might be long out of office, but I as a taxpayer would love to write a check for a few million dollars to someone who actually did work that worked in the long run and accepted the responsibility if it didn't. And so I guess there'd have to be a clawback as well as the vesting. Can I get you on board my campaign to institute this new legislative incentive system? Please?
Yeah. So first of all, I want to tell you, first, I hate the word impossible. And so when I hear people start with that, this may be impossible, that gets me more excited. And so just to give you some confidence in your stance of what you think is impossible but needed, there are a lot of governmental, especially at the local level, that are experimenting with exactly what you're saying in terms of incentivizing government actors. Like we did it when I first got in office about, hey, if you can give me an idea that will save the city of Newark $5 million, why don't you get a little bonus in pay? There is now, I love this trend in government at the local level that you're seeing, which is pay for performance. In other words, if I have a program that could save that can do prison reentry programs, and I save the federal government a significant amount of money, why shouldn't I enjoy some of that? I would love ways to tinker with the incentives of legislators down in Washington, especially if it came around saving money or creating growth or some of our shared priorities. The only thing I have to warn you about is the law of unintended consequences. And that's something that I look at everywhere. And by the way, two big tinkers that would be at the top of my list would be, again, the changing of the district lines and changing the way we finance campaigns, because we are definitely creating rational actors within government that are doing things in their own incentive to be reelected that create a more perverse reality for the democracy as a whole.
I have one final question. This is a question we ask many people on the show. Senator Cory Booker, what is something that you believe to be true for a long time until you found out you were wrong?
God. God. So I think the thing that I believe for the longest time, and please, if my mom's not listening to this, get her the clip, is I believed for years and years that by the time I was 46, I would be married with children. And I am single and childless. And so that's a sad day to wake up and realize that your life plan that you made when you were 18 and writing your goals is nowhere near true.
Look, a lot of people listen to the show. Do you want to turn this into a very brief online dating ad? Do you want to kind of verbally state your profile, what you're looking for? Is that a
You know, my staff has done a preemptive strike on that by saying you will never, ever go on online dating. If they hear me say the word Tinder ever, which I've now just violated, or J-Date, or Christian Mingle, they have a little buzzer that on my iPhone that actually shocks me. I'm a believer in love, not just in the Eros way, but I believe that the greatest love, going back to my book, is the agape way and societal love. And so I will be a purveyor of the latter, and hope that one day I stumble over the former.
Senator Booker, thank you so much.
Thank you for this great conversation. I've been an admirer of you and your show for a long time.
Thanks so much. Really nice of you to say. Be well.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Coming up after the break, some excerpts from a recent live show of ours. You'll hear about a party trick that can help you determine someone's political affiliation.
How disgusted would you be if you took a sip of a soda can and realized it wasn't yours? It was a stranger's.
It's coming up right after this.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Every so often, we put on a live version of Freakonomics Radio. In fact, our upcoming dates include May 16th in San Francisco, May 18th in Los Angeles, June 6th in Chicago, and September 7th in London. The segment you're about to hear was recorded in New York City in March. My co-host that night was Angela Duckworth, the author of Grit. And our real-time fact-checker was Jody Avergan from ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast. Our next guest is a psychology professor at Cornell who studies how people make moral and ethical judgments. Would you please welcome David Pizarro? Hi, David. What do you have for us tonight?
Suppose that you walked into a public restroom and there's...
Whatever comes next is not good.
And there's just a mess, an unflushed toilet. How disgusted would you be? Say 10, really, really, really disgusted, 0, wouldn't bother
yeah,
you
Yeah, this
all.
One goes yeah. to 11, I'm going to say.
It depends on what's in the toilet. As low as 5, as high as 10.
I'd probably be in the 3 to 6 range.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
I've seen some stuff.
My follow-up is, what do you think this has to do with who you voted for in the last election, say the presidential election?
And do you study disgust? Is that what you do?
I do study disgust.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm really easily disgusted, so it's a difficult thing to do, but that's what grad students are for.
All right, so the example you're using is an unflushed toilet. Could you could use different examples.
One of my favorite examples, actually. How disgusted would you be if you took a sip of a soda can and realized it wasn't yours? It was a stranger's.
Okay. Oh.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, people are... Not zero.
Zero, yeah.
I ate food out backstage of literally everybody's...
Yeah, my plate, actually.
Yes,
if you wanna...
and I didn't even know whose it was. Mm-hmm. It was yeah.
I was, so, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because I thought that was really strange.
It was not disgusting.
Yeah. So you're looking at how the emotion... Is disgust an emotion, by the way?
Yeah, most people call it an emotion. I mean, there's some debate because it seems a little different from the other emotions because it's so reflexive. But I think most people who study disgust would call it an emotion.
But what you're getting at is your research is about the relationship between disgust and political affiliation?
That's right, political orientation. So how conservative or liberal are you on the spectrum? And what we found, the more disgusted you were, the more likely you were to say you were conservative. We've now looked at this across different countries in different languages. We keep finding this relationship. The more easily disgusted people say they are, the more likely they are to be toward the right of the scale, less easily disgusted toward the left.
Let me ask you, so there's a question we came across in a series we've been doing on creativity, and especially if you're in the creative arts, the political orientation is way, way left. And so that led to conversations about, is there something about creativity in the arts that is correlated with liberalism? Because if you think of liberalism as essentially wanting to change the state of the thing and conservatism as an attitude toward traditionalism, I'm curious whether you have anything to say about the mechanism by which that kind of relationship may exist.
Yeah, that's been the most interesting question to us because if you just demonstrate a relationship, that doesn't get at the heart of the question. The question was, what is the nature of this relationship? So one way to ask that is, what part of conservatism is really being captured by this? And so in looking at various measures, what we see is exactly what you said, Stephen, that it's the traditionalism aspect, keeping things the way they are. So the old ways of doing things are good, don't do the new things. This shows up in other ways that you can ask the question. So one of the big findings in personality psychology is the dimension called openness to experience. People who are more liberal are very high in openness to experience. They want to try out new things. People who are more conservative are very low in openness to experience. So you can see disgust as one of those emotions that's kind of like, well, I have a set level. How risky do I want to behave for a reward? So do I try a new food?
So is it true then that picky eaters and hypochondriacs are more likely to be politically conservative?
I don't know the answer to the picky eaters. That's a very good question.
That would be your prediction, maybe,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it would be the prediction. Although, whenever I talk about this stuff, I always want to point out that this isn't like, it's not as if how grossed out you are is like 100% predictive. About between 3 and 10% of why you might be liberal or conservative seems to be captured by disgust measures.
Mm. Hey, something I've wondered about a long time is the people who care for sick people, let's say, I'm astonished that they're able to do it so well and regularly, et cetera. And I often wonder, is that acclimation or is it a trait?
That's a really good question. And in fact, Angela's colleague at Pennsylvania, Paul Rosin, one of the pioneers who studied this, did a study looking at med students, first year med students, asking this question, trying to see if you ask a bunch of questions like the ones I ask you, like in general, how easily disgusted are you in everyday life? And you get a score. So if we asked everybody here, there'd be, a nice normal distribution. Some people are really easily, some people are not. He was asking those questions of incoming med students. And what he found was that most students were like the rest of the population coming in. After a year of medical school, when, as you might know, you have to poke into bodies and you get used to bodily fluids and all that stuff, they were less disgusted when it came to that stuff, but not in general. They were still disgusted by all the other stuff, but they acclimated. So the answer to your question is we are really good at acclimating to specific things. Anybody who's a parent knows you get used to certain things.
Jody Avergan, David Pizarro has been telling us about the politics of disgust, which are really interesting and lead to a lot of interesting thoughts and questions. Anything factual we should know?
This isn't exactly a fact check, but I do want to go back to how you actually measure disgust. You ask people about hypothetical scenarios and ask them to rate how disgusted they
would be.
That's
one way
in which
we've done
that.
Other people have done the work of correlating the
actually disgusting people in real time.
Actually disgusting people. So they've brought people into the lab and they've asked them to do really gross but safe things. So would you eat a piece of chocolate shaped like dog poop?
Yes.
Right.
I think Angela's answer says less about her liberalism than about her chocolate attitude.
That may be right, and that's why there's a noisy measure. That's
exactly.
What we call
noise David measure. Pizarro, thank you so much. Thank
you.
Really enjoyed having
you.
Our next guest is a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Pittsburgh. Would you please welcome Catherine Hornbostel? Catherine, it is nice to have you. You are our last guest tonight, so make it good. What do you have for us?
So if I handed you a bucket filled with water and laundry detergent and asked you to tackle global warming, what would you do?
Oh, that's so easy.
You would wash something.
I would make a giant bubble bath, and
with
I would invite...
laundry detergent.
Hey.
Just saying.
Don't yuck my yum. I would make a giant bubble bath, and I would invite the climate lions and the climate lambs to lie down together in the bubble bath and relax and proceed to have an empirical, sane conversation about the best ways to address climate change. That's what I would do with a big bucket of soapy water.
I really like that approach.
Are we done here? Is that
the answer? Exactly what she was going to recommend.
I can't say I wrote about that approach in my paper. Do you have any other suggestions?
I don't really know what's in laundry detergent. Can you give me a hint?
Yeah, so I'm actually talking about the active ingredient sodium carbonate. I don't know if that helps.
Sodium carbonate.
Kind of
is that baking
powder,
soda or baking?
Very similar.
Okay.
Would you wash
quite.
The sky?
Not quite. What would I be washing? Are you seeing, like, throw a bubble bath in the air?
You know, like one of those geoengineering schemes that run a giant hose into the stratosphere and spray out some benign material that refracts sunlight, that kind of thing?
Is that a thing?
Not quite. That is a very creative approach. So I'll give you guys a little bit of a hint. So I'm going to send you to a coal power plant with this bucket of water and detergent.
So what is the specific, I guess, byproduct or whatever of coal burning or whatever that's bad? And then we'll be a little closer.
There are a lot of things that come off of coal that are bad. Some of them, thankfully, we already have regulations against. So things like SOx and NOx, they already scrub a lot of the crap that comes off of coal plants.
Can you give the full name of SOx and NOx, please?
So sulfur oxides and nitrous oxides.
Okay, very good.
Just gaseous compounds that are bad for the environment.
Because we all thought it was a Dr. Seuss story.
Yes. I was like, oh, that is so cute. Why would they want to legislate against them?
So carbon dioxide is the other obvious one that there are no regulations for currently for coal plants.
Are some of the emissions in a coal plant, do they react in some way negatively, I guess, with sodium carbonate? Is that the idea?
You're on the right track. You're getting very close.
So I don't think we're going to get closer without a mechanical engineering degree, which you do have.
So this particular combination, water and sodium carbonate, if you dissolve it in water, can react with carbon dioxide and extract it from a gas stream coming off a coal plant. And the really interesting thing that I've studied is that if you put these chemicals into little capsules that look like caviar, you can actually pack them into a reactor, attach it to a power plant, and selectively take out the carbon dioxide that's being released from the exhaust.
So you're describing a form of carbon capture, correct?
Yes, it is a carbon capture technology.
What stage is it in? Are you one of the inventors of said technology?
So yes, I was on a team at a national lab from the DOE that invented and kind of studied this technology. It's been demonstrated at a lab scale. Currently, we're looking for partners to
Commercialize, not
at a power plant scale yet, but at smaller scales to test out and figure out the kinks and try to scale it up more.
And what you're describing, there's obviously chemical reactions there, but is it essentially a filter?
It's a good question. It's not exactly a filter. I guess you could think of it from a big picture standpoint as a filter, though. So you're sending the nasty gas from a power plant through it. It selectively takes out carbon dioxide. At some point, it reaches capacity, and then you have to desorb or remove the CO2 from the full solution. And then
how do you do that?
So usually you have to heat up steam and send it through these capsules, and it'll take the carbon dioxide back out, and then you pressurize it and put it underground.
Okay, so it's carbon capture. Mm-hmm. You bury the carbon underground, which some people have big concerns about there. What's your level of concern on that?
I think that's very safe if you know, it's actually being done already in a lot of places. It's fairly safe, and there's a lot of science to back up the fact that it's not going to leak out or cause problems if you
put it
underground.
Does it stay there forever? Or what?
Really, it's again, if you find the right formations, that's kind of beyond my research area, but the scientists on that side are pretty confident you can store a lot of carbon dioxide underground. Just the sheer magnitude of carbon dioxide emissions requires that we put it underground at this point.
So the unit or machine that you're talking about, what do you call it?
So I guess I would call it a reactor. So
a reactor.
It's basically a giant vat filled with this solution that will react with carbon dioxide to hold it until you need to release it and store it.
So I can't tell whether it's because you cleverly began the conversation by talking about laundry detergent. Was it as simple, really, as just getting something kind of like laundry detergent and figuring out how that responded to these carbon emissions?
Yeah, I mean, so it is simple compared to other technologies for carbon capture. By putting them in small capsules, what you're essentially doing is raising the surface area. So imagine like a big vat filled with caviar. You have a very large surface area of contact between the liquid in those capsules and then the gas flowing through, which really allows you to use these very simple ingredients instead of a very tricky or corrosive solvent instead.
So you said laundry detergent is a lot like baking soda.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this might be a digression, Stephen, but since I have a mechanical engineering professor, is that little box of baking soda that I have in my refrigerator, is it really absorbing the odors?
Oh, that is an excellent question.
I love how she can tell us about carbon capture, and this is the tough question for her.
This is the most important question of the evening.
The more degrees you get, the farther removed you are from practical solutions to things like that. So sodium carbonate reacts with carbon dioxide and actually forms baking soda. So that is the reaction. That's the product of this reaction.
It's the product. Okay.
And so I guess what to emphasize here is that both the initial chemical and the final product are both very safe, very cheap, very abundant.
I have to ask this question. This is such a simple, elegant, common sense, straightforward, hiding in blinds. Was your team composed mostly of women?
We had a very good proportion of women on my team.
Just a hypothesis.
So when I hear the words safe, cheap, and abundant, it does sound literally too good to be true. So let's pretend that you were not involved with this project at all, but you knew about it, and you knew all the other competing carbon capture systems that are being developed and funded and so on. What would you put the odds of this project succeeding? I'm not saying as the only carbon capture solution, but as a significant one.
So I'm very confident that it could work if we invested and did it. Confidence in terms of whether or not this will be the winning technology, lower, much lower, just because there are a lot of technologies out there for carbon capture. There's a lot of competition. There are some other that are much more mature than ours.
Does it have a name?
And we call it MECS. It's an acronym. So microencapsulated carbonate solution.
Do you think we could crowdsource a...
Sure. I just call them capsules, but I'm open to suggestions
like
for something trendier.
I like the caviar idea.
Caviar. Carbon capture caviar. That's too
carbon
much of a mouthful.
Carbon capture caviar.
Oh, I like that.
It says here you invented something else a few years back called the pump two baby bottle.
I didn't expect you to bring that little curveball up. Yes. So I had twins when I was in grad school. I was pumping for them, and they did not nurse well. And so I invented this little hack where you can actually feed your babies breast milk as you're pumping it. So you attach it to any breast pump. As you're pumping the milk, the baby starts drinking it.
Oh, my. That is genius.
Yeah.
So
thank you.
Did you patent it? Did you make a lot of money?
In the process of patent prosecution right now. Filed for patent, working on it.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
If you are not jumping up and down with excitement about it, then you have not nursed a child or pumped.
Yes, I haven't. I'm going to confess right now. Hey, Catherine Hornbostel, thank you so much for telling us something we did not know. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or on the Stitcher podcast app. You can always get the most recent episodes or subscribe on any podcast app, including Apple Podcasts. As always, thanks for listening.